Welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, Henry Kissinger was perhaps among the most influential people on U.S. foreign policy and global events, for which some consider him a war criminal. How should Kissinger be remembered? And what does this answer say about the United States in the world? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Henry Kissinger's death has compelled a review of his life, of his politics, and for me, most notably, our memories of him and what he means to American politics. He's celebrated by many political actors as a brilliant political tactician who elevated American foreign policy and confronted political adversaries, most notably the Soviet Union during the Cold War. But he's also excoriated by political opponents as reifying the exercise of power without any regard to justice, peace, human rights, the abuses of political allies, and the destruction of so many countries, with either the support or, in some cases, the active involvement of the United States. So what exactly is the legacy of Henry Kissinger? And what does this legacy say about American foreign policy in the 21st century? Joining us today for our conversation is Jeremy Suri. He's professor in the Department of History and the LBJ School of Public Affairs. He's the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He's the author of Henry Kissinger and the American Century, and his latest book is Civil War by Other Means, America's Long and Unfinished Fight for Democracy. He's also the host of the podcast This is Democracy, and quite frankly, a great friend to the show. Thank you very much for joining us, Jeremy.
My pleasure as always. I love your show, Doug.
Thank you. And when Henry Kissinger died, immediately I contacted the producers and said, we have to have a conversation with Jeremy because of the wonderful book that you had written on Kissinger. So let's start off when thinking about Kissinger's legacy in the United States. And ultimately, I mean, I'm an international relations scholar. He's the practitioner of what we call realism, the idea of elevating American foreign policy beyond some of the domestic political debates that we have about it, and instead thinking about what's broadly in America's interest. Is that an earned legacy that he really elevated American foreign policy?
Well, whether it's an elevation or a diminution is your judgment. He certainly tried to move foreign policy away from what he thought were some impractical and harmful Wilsonian assumptions, idealistic assumptions. Henry Kissinger deeply believed that the international system was not governed by democracy, and that democracy and values associated with democracy, although perhaps important from a domestic point of view, could not be governing principles in the international system. He also believed that trade and economics, what people in your field would call international political economy, that although these issues were important, they were less important than power. That the use of military power, the use of diplomatic power, institutional power, that these were the essential components, we might call them the key ingredients, the meat and potatoes of international relations. And he believed that American foreign policy had to focus on those elements of power. It had to cultivate those elements of power, particularly military and diplomatic, and it had to use those elements of power to serve, as you said so well, Doug, the national interest. And he believed that that was at the core of what foreign policy was about, and that justice in the long run could only be served if the national interests of the United States were served. He believed that American power was essential to the international system, and that the use of that power was the fundamental goal of American policymakers, to protect the national interest and to protect world order, which would serve American national interests.
I'm going to start delving into some of the specific areas, and then we'll circle back and address this at kind of a bigger macro level. The first thing Kissinger always gets credit for is the opening to China. And certainly the idea that the United States had had this policy of non-recognition of the People's Republic of China for so many years based on the perception that the Communist Party of China had violated human rights, were undemocratic, was an illegitimate government. I think anybody could look at that and say it was about time the U.S. recognized China. But first, how much was this opening to China unique to Kissinger? And exactly how much did it accomplish at least the very specific goal he had in mind, which was winning the war in Vietnam?
So the opening to China was not Kissinger's unique idea. Richard Nixon had written about it before coming into the presidency, and many observers, Democrat and Republican, scholarly and non-scholarly, were looking at this and saying that the United States had to open relations with China in one way or another. The communist regime in China came to power in 1949. By the late 1960s, the United States was virtually the only country that did not have a diplomatic relationship. We did not recognize that the communists were the legitimate rulers of mainland China, and that made things complicated. For instance, in 1955, at the Geneva meetings over the future of Vietnam, where the Chinese showed up and the Americans, and most notoriously American Secretary of State John Foster Dulles, refused to shake Zhou Enlai's hand. So this was counterproductive, and it was isolating the United States as much as it was isolating China. So the idea of opening relations with China was not in any way unique to Henry Kissinger. Now, what has to be said, Doug, is that he oversaw the process of opening relations, and that was not easy. What we have to remember is that when the Nixon administration came into office in 1969, there was no direct contact between the U.S. and China. China was in the throes of a cultural revolution. It wasn't actually clear who one would contact there. The foreign ministry was being attacked from within, and Kissinger had to try a number of things, eventually working through Pakistan to make a connection to the Chinese and making a secret trip to China in 1971 that laid the basis for Richard Nixon's trip to China in 1972. So the day-to-day working out of it was, on the American side, overseen by Kissinger, was quarterbacked by Kissinger, but it wasn't a unique idea he had.
And then one of the real motivations why the U.S. wanted to reach out to China was, first of all, the recognition the Chinese and the Soviets were certainly not on the same page, and there was a great deal of acrimony, and in particular, the overwhelming issue for Americans, the Vietnam War, this belief that China somehow held the key to the U.S. winning that war. First of all, that isn't how it played out, right? I mean, what role did China play in the Vietnam War?
So the Chinese were supporters of North Vietnam from very early on. They provided supplies, they provided various other things. But the North Vietnamese, as the scholarship of the last 10 to 20 years has shown, the North Vietnamese were pretty independent actors. And in fact, in some ways, were anti-Chinese. They had a long history of fighting China, as they did a long history of fighting France and a short history of fighting the United States. So the Chinese did not control the North Vietnamese. And this is one of the mistakes that Kissinger made, thinking that somehow, if he worked through Beijing and worked through Moscow, he could somehow change the behavior of the North Vietnamese, and that proved not to be the case. It did, however, help the United States by establishing relations with China because it did provide some international cover against the argument that the United States was hell-bent on destruction throughout Asia. Kissinger made the case after 72 that the United States was actually seeking peace, peace in Vietnam and peace elsewhere. And even though he didn't win the Nobel Peace Prize for the opening to China, he won it for the settlement in Vietnam with Lee Duc Tho in 1973. And it's, of course, questionable whether he deserved the Peace Prize for that. The opening to China contributed to that because he was creating an image that the United States was not just seeking war in the region, but seeking peace.
Yeah, and we're going to get into the Nobel Peace Prize in just a moment. But staying on this theme for Vietnam, I always think that perception that the Chinese had this unique control or influence over the North Vietnamese, first of all, showed, you know, betrayed a complete lack of historical knowledge of even the choice that Ho Chi Minh took as his name, a reference to a, if I remember correctly, late 14th century Vietnamese leader who had opposed the, you know, the Chinese, and China will actually invade to topple him as he's trying to institute a social revolution. So first of all, a reminder to leaders, read your history, and right, you can learn a great deal.
Right.
But ultimately, it reminds me of a line that Kissinger's kind of famous for when describing a conflict. I actually don't remember which conflict this was, but he said, "You might be right locally, but I'm thinking globally." So I've always considered that to be potentially one of the real failures of Kissinger, was his tendency to view everything through the global lens, as opposed to actually paying attention to local conditions.
As I myself have written, I think that was a flaw in his thinking, particularly when the places he was working on were places he did not know well. But one of his strengths was that he could look at, for instance, European politics with a deep understanding of Europe, but also a global perspective that most European specialists did not have. And if you look at, for instance, the way he handled relations during the period of detente, there were certain advantages in having this global as well as local perspective. But when he was working on areas he did not understand well, and here Exhibit A is Chile and much of Latin America. One could also talk about Bangladesh in 1971, East Timor. These were areas where the global perspective ran roughshod over the reality of what was on the ground, and that often meant that the local was suffering for the ambitions of the global. And again, Chile is a really clear example of this. The socialist elected government in 1970 of Salvador Allende was in no way a great government, but it was an elected government, and it had won legitimately. And Kissinger and Nixon acted to overthrow that government, helped to sponsor the coup that produced one of the dirtiest, most authoritarian regimes in the region, a regime that actually encouraged that behavior in other regimes that led to tens of thousands of Chileans and other citizens of that region suffering. And so that was a local cost, a terrible local cost, an unacceptable local cost to what was a global policy of communist containment and anti-Castro activities. So you're right, there were costs in many places. And that's why, as I've been saying, and as I've written extensively, I mean, his record is mixed. I'm not on the side of those who think that everything he did was horrible. And I'm not on the side at all of those who think that everything he did was genius and the model of statesmanship. I think his career is so interesting for us, Doug, as scholars and as citizens, because it teaches us about the possibilities, but also the hazards of American power.
Oh, absolutely. And I think in the case of Chile, maybe the most damning thing about the overthrow of Allende is that Chile was, at least in the Southern Cone, and I believe throughout the entire region, the longest continuous democracy within the region. So this broad support for democracy, for norms, even if you think they've chosen a leader that is perhaps a bit less democratic or certainly not supportive of the same norms, you support the principle, you know, of democracy. And that, not just the legacy of Kissinger, but the contemporary American legacy, I guess one of the lessons is we get so tied up in the very specifics of the case that we kind of forget the importance of the norms.
I think that's right. And I think also just building on, I think your very well-stated point, Doug, those norms have power attached to them, that norms do become a source of influence. This is the point that international theorists would often make in criticism of realism, and I think they're right, that reputation matters, image matters, trust matters. This was enormously costly, the mistakes the United States made in places like Chile and elsewhere. I was just in Brazil this summer, and people in that region have not forgotten. And it's very hard when trying to convince in today's world Brazilians, for instance, to trust the United States more than China. It's hard to distinguish who the United States is from China in their eyes. We say we're a democracy, China's not. And the Brazilians say, no, but you supported a dictatorial authoritarian regime in Brazil. What makes you different from the Chinese? Why should we favor you over the Chinese? And so these reputational costs, as IR theorists tell us correctly, they have power attached to them and they have long-term effects.
Absolutely. And I think to stay in that region then, the implications for contemporary politics is, I think any of us watching what's going on in Argentina today are asking, first of all, how can a leader like Milei be elected in Argentina? He seems so terrible for Argentine democracy and for the Argentine economy. But I mean, if you're a Democrat, small d, democracy sometimes make mistakes and support for the democracy matters. So kind of the lesson that we should have learned in Chile, we seem to be learning in Argentina.
I think that's right, though. I think Kissinger, if he were still with us, if he lived past his 100th and a half birthday, I think he'd say that what's happened in Argentina has also shown us that you don't get to choose who your partners are, that it would be ineffective. And I think he'd be right on this, for us to say, OK, Milei is a horrible Peronist fascist, we're not going to work with you. Kissinger would say, no, we need to find a way to work with him. The challenge is, how do we work with him without reinforcing the worst of his behavior? But we cannot throw up our hands and say, this is not an acceptable government to us in the United States, that the Argentines made that choice.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. Today's show, The Legacy of Henry Kissinger. And our guest is Jeremy Suri of the University of Texas at Austin. And so since Kissinger is probably most known for his desire, his exercise of power, almost reification of power in international relations, that seems to be at the core of the realist interpretation, you know, the way Kissinger would describe himself as a realist. The one thing he seemed terribly disinterested in are issues like human rights. What was the actual humanitarian impact of the exercise, you know, of that power? And specifically, I want to turn to 1971. You made the reference to Bangladesh. the support for what, quite frankly, was a genocidal policy on the part of the Pakistanis in the destruction of Bangladesh. And I think historically, I think the record would show the right position was support for Bangladeshi independence. Kissinger was on the other side of that issue.
Yes, and it was because Pakistan was one of the most important allies for the United States in the region. As I mentioned earlier, Pakistan had been the go-between for the United States to open relations with China. Pakistan was favored by Kissinger and Nixon, as it was by prior American presidents over India, because it was a reliable military ally of the United States. India, even though it was a democracy, was less reliable as an ally and was in some ways closer to the Soviet Union. So Pakistan was a key American ally. And for that reason, Kissinger strongly believed that helping the Pakistanis to hold their country together, which they were seeking to do, was an important goal. The genocidal consequences of that of those policies, some of that was evident to him at the time, some might not have been, but I think he's responsible for that. I think he's responsible for the implications of his policies. If he's going to take credit for opening to China, he's got to take the criticism and the condemnation for the consequences of his actions in Pakistan. It just should be said the Pakistanis were the ones making the genocidal policy. The United States was supporting it.
That's why there's a difference between his supporting of regimes that are committing atrocities versus actually the actual commission of atrocities. But when you think broadly about that question, not just is he on the wrong side ethically in history in supporting a regime that was committing genocide, but also even from a realist perspective, that the most important actor in that region has always been India. And this opportunity to align with India, a fellow democracy, by the way, so that there should be a ties between India and the United States. But right now, what is the most complicated relationship, certainly in that region, and really quite frustrating to the United States, is the lack of a close relationship with India. So even from a power perspective, it didn't seem like it was the right policy.
Well, so Kissinger would argue, and when confronted with this, as he was both in writing, and in fact, he and I talked about this once. My family's from India, so I feel a particular connection to this. And I'd like to think that India and the United States is the two largest democracies in the world, that there should be a natural connection between them, though I worry about the state of democracy in India right now, as I also worry about in the United States. So that's another conversation. Kissinger's response, though, is that he was acting actually as realpolitik would dictate, because our two key allies were the Chinese and the Pakistanis, and that India actually had not been a reliable ally of the United States, that India was pursuing its own set of policies to try to make itself a regional power, often at the cost of American interests, and that the United States was choosing China and Pakistan over India. That's not to say the United States was seeking an adversarial relationship with India, but India was not the key American ally. Another point on realism that's relevant for India and relevant for our discussion, Doug, is I think where Kissinger's realism falls down is his belief that the United States is a special country. And it relates to all your questions, because he believed fundamentally that power for the United States, even if it caused terrible harm to others, in the long run would be better for the world. And as I argue in my book, this came from his experience of being a refugee to the United States, fleeing the Holocaust, and the role he saw the United States playing in World War II. And he's a product of that moment. He's a product of the Holocaust in World War II. He comes to the United States age 15, not even speaking any English. And he becomes an American serving in counterintelligence in the military during World War II. And so for him, this is not realism. It can't be, because for realism, all nation states are the same, right? Power is about the pursuit of power by nation states, and what doesn't matter whether the nation state is named United States or Russia, they're in the same game. That's not true for Kissinger. For Kissinger, the United States was special. It was the first among equals. And so in South Asia, if something benefited American power, even at the cost of, in this case, hundreds of thousands of Bangladeshis, if it benefited American power, in the long run, he believed it would be in the benefit of everyone in the region. And that's how he viewed the world. That's a difference in his realism from the academic realism. It's what made him an American nationalist as well as a realist.
By the way, an observation dating back to the 40s, that was always George Kennan's big complaint about this notion of American exceptionalism, is that the U.S. never accepted the realist principle that all states are kind of the same. And so even when realism gets used, and certainly in the 21st century, when you have people talking about a realist foreign policy, It's not exactly realist because it has this presumption of American exceptionalism, American, idealism, and that the world needs the US to lead it because the US is somehow, is somehow special. But Kissinger made that sound like realism,
He
which has
did.
had profound implications.
He did because to Americans, especially of his generation, the specialness of the United States was axiomatic and unquestionable. And that's what made George Kennan, who is a true realist, I think, that's what made Kennan such an outlier and why his foreign policy career was so short and why Henry Kissinger's was so long.
Now, you mentioned East Timor. I want to delve into this one as well, because this is yet another case where, I mean, the local conditions, it was a Portuguese colony rather than a Dutch colony. It was separate from Indonesia. Actually, one of the big differences, Indonesia being overwhelmingly Muslim, East Timor being overwhelmingly Roman Catholic. Yet when East Timor gains its independence after Portugal decolonizes in the mid-70s, Kissinger not only says nothing, but apparently is rather supportive of Indonesia's invasion of East Timor, which creates two scenarios. One is all the violence and the atrocities upon the invasion. And then, of course, 25 years later, a genocide against the East Timorese. So his legacy in Southeast Asia, not just in Vietnam, but certainly in, East Timor, leaves a great deal to be desired, correct?
I agree. And his view was that that region of the world, like any region, was dominated by some natural big powers, and the Indonesians were one of them. And so East Timor as a separate state was a vulnerability. And so he did not support, this is a little different from Bangladesh, he did not support genocidal behavior at his time, but he did support the Indonesian government violently going in and taking control of East Timor. It is interesting, though, that even though, as you say, I think accurately, Doug, his record in Southeast Asia is not a good one in many respects, he's still probably the most respected American in that area, in Singapore, and of course in China, and even it's strange, even in Vietnam. I mean, there's a kind of grudging respect for him. Some of that is the current relationship between the U.S. and Vietnam, which is actually a somewhat cooperative relationship. But his record and his reputation often differed, which is also an interesting phenomenon.
And speaking of his record, reputation, et cetera, I have to admit that I've used this line many times when talking about the Nobel Peace Prize. It can't be that impressive of a prize. Henry Kissinger has won. How on earth did Henry Kissinger win a Nobel Peace Prize?
Well, I think he won the Nobel Peace Prize for many reasons that are similar to why Barack Obama won it. Now, I don't mean he's like Barack Obama or Barack Obama's like him in any way, but these were two prominent American figures who I think we could say had not earned the Peace Prize. But they won it because they had, in their time, attracted a very, very powerful political following of people who believed, in Obama's case, that this was someone who's going to change the world, and in Kissinger's case, that he was saving the world. Let's just remember when he comes into power in 69, it looks like the United States is in an endless quagmire in Vietnam. We're facing a conflict. The Soviet Union has just invaded Czechoslovakia. The world looks like it's entering a very, very dangerous, difficult period, and American power looks unstable. And what he does in China, in Vietnam, in the Middle East, which we haven't talked about yet, and elsewhere, he makes American power look effective again. And he becomes the arch diplomat going around the world negotiating agreements that seem to limit wars in different parts of the world. And that attracts a great deal of excitement. That attracts a great deal of attention. And this is so important. He seems to be someone who's able to control the events around him, to transcend the events around him. And I think the Nobel Peace Prize Committee gets caught up in that. They're glad, they're relieved the United States is finally leaving Vietnam, even though it's too late. They're relieved we've opened relations with China. And so they're embracing that in the same way I think they were trying to embrace a different vision of policy with Barack Obama.
And I don't agree with you on that. I actually think one aspect of Barack Obama winning the Nobel Peace Prize was the historic nature of having a man of color winning presidency and what that means for democracy in the United States. Though I'm not sure he earned it because of that. I've always been a little bit more accepting of that.
I agree with that. I would accept that.
You mentioned the Middle East. Let's talk about Kissinger's record in the Middle East. Obviously, he oversaw the U.S. response to the Yom Kippur War and what became really a kind of a blank check to Israel, which we're seeing now, certainly with, similar implications, as a result of Israel's military responses to and their aggression responses to October the 7th, and a lot of other countries, the US's role in places like Lebanon, which becomes embroiled in a massive civil war as well. US record in the Middle East under Kissinger definitely leaves a lot to be desired.
Well, I think it depends how you look at it, right? He would argue, and I think his defenders with some merit would argue, that the 1973 war, which of course shakes Israel to its foundation when all of its Arab neighbors attack it, then turns into another kind of war when Israel is able to retaliate and gain more territory. Kissinger steps in to what looks like an endless cycle of violence, particularly between Israel and Egypt. And he's able to negotiate or begin to negotiate a deal that Carter will later complete that makes war between Israel and Egypt something that doesn't happen again. That's an extraordinary achievement. He brings stability to the region, to that relationship. Think how much worse things would be today if Israel and Egypt were fighting. We worry about Israel and Iran getting into a war. Imagine if Israel and Egypt were in a war today. This gives the United States also enormous leverage in the region. Let's remember that in the early 70s, the Soviets are a pretty fair competitor with the United States for influence in the region. Kissinger sidelines the Soviet Union completely. And in Cold War terms, that's a huge victory to make the United States the key player in the region. That puts a target on our back for later periods. So there's no doubt there are costs to that. But in its time, that is a huge achievement. And then we should also, Doug, comment on what you certainly know well, which is the energy Kissinger puts into what's called the shuttle diplomacy, spending months shuttling, quite literally, between Cairo and Amman and Damascus and Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, or negotiating all kinds of agreements to try to bring stability to the region. So I think there's a lot that is achieved there, and the region is less war-torn if you compare it after 73, 74, to where it was 56, 67, 73, in part because of his influence. Now, the Palestinians are left out of this story. There's no doubt about that. That's intentional on his part. We had actually did a whole podcast on this and on my podcast. There is a way in which Kissinger's world is a world dominated by states, big, strong states, and he sees the Egyptian government as the key Arab state. The Palestinians get left out of this. The Egyptians get bought off. They become the second largest recipients of U.S. foreign aid. Israel, of course, is the largest as a consequence of this moment. So the Palestinians are left out, but the hope was always among those who came after Kissinger that there would be room for negotiation with a new Palestinian leadership. To some extent, Israel doesn't follow through on that. I agree with you, with your premise. But I think it also has to be said that the Palestinian leadership is particularly poor at pursuing peaceful relations as well. The Egyptian government recognizes the legitimacy of Israel. The Palestinian leadership takes a long time. It takes until Oslo, I think, for the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization. And the cycles of violence that we're seeing now are cycles of violence that did not have to come out of those agreements. I don't think we can blame Kissinger for that. I think what's happened is that Israeli politics has been hijacked by the far right and by settlers, a settler community that both Kissinger and Rabin and others did not like. Kissinger was not a fan of the settlers. There's nothing he did to encourage settlement in the West Bank or elsewhere. And it has to be said that the Palestinian leadership has fallen prey for all kinds of reasons to the most extreme forms of terroristic leadership. And what Hamas did on October 7th, I mean, there's no excuse, there's no way of talking about it other than the most brutal form of terrorism. And that didn't have to be an outcome. That's a set of choices that were made, not by the Palestinian people, who I think have been largely victimized, but by those who have been able to attain power in the Palestinian territory. So I see both sides being victimized by extremist elements within, extremists in Israel and extremists in the Palestinian areas.
Last theme I want to wrestle with then is how much Kissinger is responsible or gets blamed for some of these horrific humanitarian conditions. A brief list of places we haven't really talked about: Cambodia, of course, the U.S. invasion, the bombings, and the absolute humanitarian disaster Cambodia, you know, had become. I had referenced before Lebanon, another country that certainly being sucked into the conflict, becoming a humanitarian disaster. And all of this is a reminder that one of Kissinger's enduring legacies. I remember when Augusto Pinochet was arrested and was to be extradited to Spain back in the late 90s, when a Spanish judge named Baltasar Garzon wanted to put him on trial, Kissinger was apparently in Paris at the time and was told by his lawyer to get out of Paris very, very quickly and get back to the United States because of concerns that he could be put on trial as a war criminal or as somebody who's committed human rights abuses. I mean, it was certainly a fear on the part of Kissinger, but he gets described as a war criminal. Is that a legitimate description?
I struggle with this, and I struggled through like 25 interviews of this after he died. And I struggle with it in my book, in part because I'm not an international lawyer, right? I think it is fair to say that the United States committed actions during the Cold War that we would today consider war crimes. And maybe some of them were considered war crimes in their time. You listed some of the obvious examples, right? The bombing of civilians in Cambodia, the organizing and support of a coup that leads to the repression of people. So, and then there's also, I think, the impeachable offenses. And I'd remind people that actually one of the offenses that Nixon was initially up for impeachment on was actually lying to Congress about the war in Vietnam, lying about Cambodia. And that, of course, involved Kissinger as well, even though Kissinger, I don't think, had testified. So he hadn't done it under oath. The president, I think, had. So there are all these issues. And I think it's fair to say that war crimes were committed by the United States during the Cold War. Where I have trouble singling Kissinger out, Doug, is because what he did was within the mainstream of American policymaking. And by that measure, and maybe this is where we should go, but by that measure, Zbigniew Brzezinski, Dean Rusk, Colin Powell, Condi Rice, Barack Obama would all be possibly considered war criminals. And to me, that can't be true. If it's the entire establishment of American foreign policy, there's clearly something for us to learn about perhaps rethinking our foreign policy. But if they're all war criminals and criminality implies in some way going outside the norms and what they were doing were the norms of behavior, at least as recognized by American policymakers, it doesn't make them right. But it makes it hard for me to see how they should be charged as war criminals individually.
Which then leaves us with the conclusion here that in the 21st century, there's been a number of arguments, whether it's support for Palestinians broadly, particularly among progressives in the United States, demands for respect for human rights, for respect for humanitarian law, et cetera, that it might be fair to say from the historian's perspective, we may be committing a bit of a fallacy reading back and presuming that these were parts of the discourses during Kissinger's time, late 60s, throughout the 70s, and even, perhaps up until the turn of the century. But perhaps it's fair to say maybe the greatest lesson that we learned from Kissinger's legacy is that though it may be understandable in that context, I'm not sure I'm ready to concede that yet, but it may be understandable in that context, it certainly would not be in the 21st century. So is Kissinger's legacy, he is a 20th century figure and should be left there?
Well, to some extent, yes. And I think that's true for any impactful, consequential figure. They reflect the morality of their time. They reflect the circumstances of their time. And we learn from them. That's why I call my book Henry Kissinger, American Century. We learn from them about their time. What fascinates me about Kissinger most is that he's a figure who becomes probably the most powerful unelected policymaker in the United States after World War II for the longest period. And he's never elected, as I said, to anything. He doesn't have a fancy name when he starts out. He doesn't have money. He's a refugee. How does he rise to power? By serving powerful people through patronage networks. And so that tells us something about what powerful people wanted, how powerful people viewed the world in the United States. He's a window. If what he was doing was out of the mainstream, he never would have been able to do it because he didn't have enough money to do it on his own, and he didn't have the access to resources on his own. So he's a window in the same way that I think those of us who study other periods, someone like John Quincy Adams is a window into his period.
We've been talking about the legacy of Henry Kissinger, and our guest, Jeremy Suri, professor in the Department of History, the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. Perhaps most importantly, the author of a book, Henry Kissinger and the American Century. If you want to know more about Kissinger and that legacy, a wonderful book there. And the most recent publication, Civil War by Other Means, America's Long and Unfinished Fight for Democracy. And by the way, if you're not really a reader, but you just want to listen, he has a wonderful podcast called This is Democracy. Jeremy, thank you very much for joining us.
Doug, thank you for the great questions. As always, I always enjoy talking with you.
Thank you.
In 1979, Vietnam invaded Cambodia and overthrew the genocidal Khmer Rouge government. What have been the consequences of that decision?
Stay with us.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In 1979, Vietnam invaded Cambodia and overthrew the genocidal Khmer Rouge government. Cambodia was ravaged by war, partly caused by U.S. bombings. What have been the consequences of this? Doug Becker explores the reasons for the invasion with the author of a new book.
I'm Doug Becker. In 1979, Vietnam invaded Cambodia and overthrew the Khmer Rouge governments. This government had committed genocide since its seizure of power in 1975. Vietnam's motivations have been asserted in a wide range of explanations, from the advancement of communism based on Marxist-Leninist ideology to humanitarian interests in protecting Vietnamese populations targeted by the Khmer Rouge in their genocide, to a strategic interest in expanding Vietnamese power in the region. In a new book entitled Vietnam Strategic Thinking During the Third Indochina War, Kosal Poth examines this decision and its impact. Professor Poth is assistant professor of political science at Brooklyn College, and he's joined us for this conversation. So first, Professor Poth, what conditions in Cambodia led to Vietnam's decision to invade? What was going on in Cambodia that would compel an invasion?
It's a long story. I'm going to give you a brief history of the conflict between the Cambodian communists and the Vietnamese communists. In 1951, the Communist Party of Indochina was divided into three parties, one party for each country. So you have the Vietnamese Communist Party for Vietnam, the Cambodian Communist Party for Cambodia, and the other one for Laos. So it's kind of a triple alliance against the French colonialists. So fast forward to the conflict. In 1954, so this is following the independence, Cambodia gained independence from France in 1953. So you have several factions in Cambodia. You have Sihanouk regimes, the Songkhum Rinnayum government, which is very popular, in control and supported by the French, and the Khmer communists, Cambodian communists, were not part of the Paris Peace Conference in 1954. Unlike the Vietnamese, unlike the Laotian Communist Party, they were part of the conference. Instead, Sihanouk regime was part of the conference. And so in 1955, the conference decided that the Sihanouk Songkhum Rinnayum will organize a general election. All parties in conflict were invited to be part of the election. But the Khmer communists knew very well that they would not be able to win the election. What they decided to do is that they're going to split the party. They're going into hiding. So it's about 2,000 of 3,500 strong decided to go to North Vietnam with the communists, the retreating communists. Some decided to stay behind and continue the kind of a secret communist cell within the Sihanouk control regime. So in 1961, this is really after years of repressions by the Sihanouk regime, the Khmer communists was on the retreat. So they were weakened tremendously. They were repressed. One particular cell, the Phnom Penh cell, was controlled by the communists from France, including Solop Saw or Pol Pot and his French, the returning students. So this later on became the leader of the Democratic Cambodia or the Khmer leaders. So this cell grew very strong. They hijacked the Communist Party. So Pol Pot usurped the power, became the General Secretary of the Khmer Communist Party in 1962. And in 1963, he began to plan for the Communist Party to fight back against the Songkhum Rinnayum run by Sihanouk, and also to become a major party to the future vision of the country. So let's go back to what was going on in Vietnam. So the main story is that basically this is really the Vietnamese communist surprise attacks against the United States across South Vietnam, right? So this is sort of the what we know in the United States, kind of the Vietnam War. But there's a story to that that related to Cambodia. Because at that time, Sihanouk regime decided to offer support to the Vietnamese communists, because he was not comfortable enough with the United States, and he was concerned about the coup d'etat, he was concerned about the American plot to assassinate him So what he saw in South Vietnam was not something that he would like to see happen to himself. The Vietnam War turned out to be victorious for the Vietnamese communists. So therefore, he, under this cloak of neutrality, the Sihanouk regime and his military leader, including Lon Nol, decided to offer support to the Vietnamese communists against the United States, hoping that by the end of the war, he will make peace with the victorious Vietnamese communists to resolve the outstanding border dispute between the two countries. This is the beginning of Pol Pot grievances and grudge toward the Vietnamese communists. They felt betrayed that the Vietnamese communists did not fully support them against the Sihanouk, and they decided to sleep with Sihanouk. And so from the very beginning, Pol Pot never trusted the Vietnamese communists to begin with in the 1960s. So in 1966, when he went to see Mao Zedong in China, he began to chart a different course for the Communist Party of Cambodia with him at the helm. So here you have a sort of Maoist brand of Khmer communism and the sort of the Vietnamese brand of communism, like more pro-Soviet Union. So by 1973, the conflict turned to be very serious. Once again, the Cambodian communists were not part of the January 1973 Paris Peace Conference. And so they felt, Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge leader felt betrayed by the Paris Peace Agreement. The Vietnamese decided to end the war, to negotiate the war, and did not allow Cambodia to be part of the negotiation. As a result, the Nixon administration bombed Cambodia, bombed the communists, right after the Paris Peace Conference in 1973. So as a result, the Vietnamese felt that they had to talk to the Khmer leadership. So in September 1974, this is before, just 1 year before both countries became victorious and came to power, they sent a high delegation to the Cambodians' jungle to meet the Khmer leader. And the Khmer leader gave the Vietnamese delegation a cold reception. And one of the major conflicts that I saw in the sort of secret memo report back then is that the Pol Pot Khmer Rouge were very, very upset about the outcome of the Paris Peace Agreement in 1973, that the Vietnamese betrayed them. Because of that negotiation, because of that Paris Peace Conference, the Nixon administration decided to bomb Cambodia, and a lot of communists were killed, a lot of the sanctuaries were destroyed. And so that's the major break. And the Khmer Rouge communists began to purge all Khmer communists who were trained by the Vietnamese, trained by the North Vietnamese. This is well before the genocide that took place in Cambodia. This is well before they came to power in April 1975. So that is a one major historical conflict between the two communist parties. But the other part of the conflict that played such an important role that triggered the Vietnamese communists to invade Cambodia, it began with a kind of irredentist nationalism. When the Khmer Rouge came to power in Cambodia in 1975, April 75, the next month, in May 1975, they began an assault to take over islands, some of the islands in the Gulf of Thailand from the Vietnamese control. This is the beginning of the Khmer Rouge assault attack on Vietnam. The plan is to take over lost territory from the Vietnamese. So territory is also central to the Khmer Rouge's initiation of attack. So to be clear, the Khmer Rouge attacked the Vietnamese first, and they thought they could win the war, at least to take over a large section of the territory, and then began the negotiation. But the Vietnamese responded with massive attack, and they decided to retake all those islands and territory quickly after the Khmer Rouge assault. So the Khmer Rouge failed to do that, but they did not stop. They continued to attack into Vietnam. So this is the beginning of the conflict. From the Vietnamese perspective, they were puzzled why the Khmer Rouge, much weaker than the Vietnamese Communist Party and the military, and why they decided to attack Vietnam first. The only logical explanation from the Vietnamese perspective was that it must be Beijing behind them. Beijing supported the Khmer Rouge, and that's why the Khmer Rouge had the prowess to attack Vietnam. And so this is a critical period. Between 1975 and 1977, the Vietnamese were studying the situation. So they decided not to invade Cambodia back then. They could have done so, but they thought that they need to do one thing before they decide to invade Cambodia, and that is to make sure that the Soviet Union was fully behind them, right? So in June 1978, they signed a military pact with the Soviet Union, and then they were certain that the Soviet Union offered full support for the military campaign against the Khmer Rouge to change the regime in Phnom Penh and rebuild a new pro-Hanoi regime in Cambodia, and then get it off the Chinese influence altogether. So that is the major cause of the invasion.
Okay, so this is interesting in that this is a conflict that frequently gets described in our field of international relations as an element of the so-called strategic triangle, because you've got the Chinese-backed Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, and you've got the Soviet-backed Vietnamese, and then, of course, the U.S. having to make a decision on whether or not they can open a rift between China and the Soviet Union. But what you're describing is that the conflict itself was driven, is it fair to say, more by personality or, you know, personal decisions about the leadership of the subsequent communist parties, and in particular, the Vietnamese communist government's refusal to fully back Pol Pot and instead support his adversaries or potential adversaries. So Pol Pot seeking out Chinese support, and that ultimately is what's driving this conflict, is this sort of battle for the leadership within the party? Or are there also some strategic interests or broader sort of big game China versus the Soviet Union sort of issues that are also driving this?
So in my book, I make two central arguments. First, unlike most existing studies which attributed Vietnam's decision to invade Cambodia in December 1978 to kind of Vietnamese political elites' paranoia, imperial ambition over Indochina. So these are the main argument written by previous scholars, right? So, and a lot of Cambodians think that too, and the Khmer Rouge in particular thinks that the Vietnamese always have this imperial design over Cambodia. Start with the Communist Party of Indochina, so they can control Cambodia and Laos kind of as two little brother, and the Vietnamese will lead the pack, right? Then the other argument would be sort of Marxist-Leninist ideology, that this is really the conflict between the sort of Pol Pot Maoist brand against the pro-Soviet Vietnamese communists. So the brothers in conflict, two red brothers in conflict. My argument is that Hanoi's decision to invade Cambodia in December 1978 was rational. That is Hanoi's strategic move to cement and its alliance with the Soviet Union to solve domestic crisis at home and counter imminent threat posed by this Sino-Cambodian alliance. And so it's a rational action. It's a rational calculation. It's a calculated decision-making process. The two problems from the Vietnamese perspective in 1978, first, they have an economic crisis at home. Serious economic crisis at home. The first five-year plan after Vietnam was united failed miserably. And on top of that, they suffered this massive damage by drought and flooding in 1977-78. And then, so on top of that, you have a population that after 30 years war against the France and United States, there was kind of war fatigue. So the military was really in disarray at that point, right? And so the Vietnamese had to think rationally about what to do. The reluctant to invade Cambodia early on, as I talked about earlier, why not 1976, 1977, when the Khmer Rouge attacked them repeatedly? Why did they decide not to do then? Why did they wait until December 1978? I think this is a very important point, because again, you got to look at the domestic crisis in Vietnam. The crisis of legitimacy. The Vietnamese Communist Party was in trouble in 1978. So there's a lot of popular complain about corruptions, about food crisis, all kind of things, all kind of complaints against parties members. So there is a serious socio-economic crisis at home. And then you have this sort of the Sino-Cambodian threat, right, from both sides, from the north, from the south. So those are the two major crises, major threat to Vietnam that the Vietnamese leader was thinking about. And the Soviet Union became the must-have a kind of solution. The Soviet can deal with both economic crisis at home, can help them with economic crisis at home, and also to deal with the Sino-Cambodian threat. And this is my argument that this is a rational calculation. They decide to sign a treaty, friendship treaty with the Soviet Union in June 1978, to address both economic crisis at home and the national security threat posed by the Sino-Cambodian alliance. It is a rational calculation.
And one of the things that makes that so striking is, and in the book you certainly highlight this, that at the end of the day, what the Vietnamese had chosen to do, though they may be militarily stronger than the Cambodians, but if you bring the Chinese into the calculation, and certainly eventually the American support for the Chinese position, suddenly Vietnam is facing, you know, potentially a much more significant amount of power against them. But against those odds, perhaps, Vietnam has had rather quite a lot of success. They end up toppling the Khmer Rouge government and dominating Cambodian politics quite directly for 10 years. And right. Then seemingly still has quite a bit of domination. First of all, how did Vietnam do that? How were they so successful in their occupation? And then how has it continued even after the Vietnamese army will withdraw from Cambodia, yet their chosen successor continues to play, I think it's fair to say, the most significant role in contemporary Cambodian politics?
Why successful? Well, to be direct, the Vietnamese military was strong. I mean, they had 1 million strong active soldiers right after they defeated the United States. So there's an enormous amount of military power still in place, despite the fact that I said that some military personnel were released from active duty to do economic work because of the economic crisis, but there's still a massive amount of firepower right on the part of the Communist Party of Vietnam. I must stress one thing. The success of the Vietnamese Communist Party, in my view, is their ability to mobilize resources. And that is extraordinary through the First Indochina War, the Second Indochina War, and the Third Indochina War, against the French, the United States, and China. The ability to mobilize was extraordinary. So it's fair to say that the Communist Party of Vietnam and the Vietnamese state is an extractive, resource-extractive state. They were able to rally people behind the flag very quickly using the emotion, combine the emotions and the firepower, and to defeat the Khmer Rouge very quickly. And the fact that the Khmer Rouge was so brutal against the Vietnamese, they committing war crimes and raping against the Vietnamese innocents along the border, provide emotional power to the invasion. I think that's I can't stress enough. So that's the success of the part of the success is their ability to mobilize, and also with the support from the Soviet Union, they were able to actually defeat the Khmer Rouge effectively. I have to say that it's not all successful story. What they failed to foresee at the time, based on available documents, new documents, is that they failed to predict the Chinese invasion of northern Vietnam in February 1979 in response to the Vietnamese invasion of Cambodia. And they failed to predict that. And they had to withdraw a large numbers of Vietnamese troops from Cambodia to deal with the Chinese invading army in northern Vietnam. So they failed to predict that. I think it was a miscalculation. They thought that China was a paper tiger. They had a lot of domestic problems, and they were not able to respond militarily against the Vietnamese invasion of Cambodia. That part was a miscalculation. If you look at the Vietnamese narrative, it was never a fail. They always had everything figured out. But in the document that I looked at, no, they did not predict that, and led to the Vietnamese failure to predict that. Cost enormously in terms of economic infrastructure. The Chinese invading army destroyed pretty much northern Vietnam economic infrastructures, roads, and livestock, and so on. And the other part of you allude to the success of regime change and then build a new regime that is pro-Vietnam. Yes, to an extent, from 1979 to 1989, it's fair to say that the Vietnamese was involved in all aspects of nation building, from building a new party, building an army, building infrastructure, the government structure from the central government, central party, all the way to the district level. And I describe that in the book in detail. I'm not going to mention here. So the Vietnamese basically wanted to export their blueprint, right, socialist framework model to Cambodia. So they were successful in doing that. up until 1989 when they withdrew from Cambodia. Well, fast forwarding to Cambodia today, I would say that this is, I think, the Vietnamese look back to this Cambodia chapter with a sense of, I would say they quite disappointed that now the Hun Sen government turned to China. If you look at every day in Cambodia, the Vietnamese would never fail to notice rising influence of the Chinese Communist Party and the Chinese government in Cambodia. So in a way, they went to Cambodia to try to end Chinese influence in Cambodia, which turned to threaten them militarily. Now it's more like a comeback, sort of history repeats itself. I think that's the main concern, looking from the Hanoi perspective.
So a fascinating examination of Vietnam's interests, and in particular their strategic interests, in the decision to invade Cambodia, and certainly, as Professor Poff has highlighted, reliant on a lot of new information that's been released, and some really wonderful primary research done by Professor Poff in this book. The book is called Vietnam Strategic Thinking During the Third Indochina War. It is available if you'd like to pick it up. I would encourage you, to read that. Thank you very much, Professor Poff. This has been very, very interesting. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Mahika Chechi is our assistant producer. Sud Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.